Young, it's Here and Now. Coming up, our conversation with bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, who's asking a lot of questions about mental health care, including why don't the mentally ill have as much insurance coverage as people with any other illness? But first, six men described as Islamic militants are under arrest, accused of plotting to attack the Fort Dix Army base in New Jersey with assault weapons and kill as many U.S. soldiers there as possible. That's according to federal prosecutors, who will provide details about the allegations later today. Officials say four of the accused are Muslims from the former Yugoslavia. One news report says the men trained with paintball and real guns in the Pocono Mountains. Well, joining us on the line is Shai Ben-Yaakov, reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Shai, what more do we know? Who are these six men?
Well, as you said, four are from the former Yugoslavia. We know that three of those are brothers, and they live in a suburb of Philadelphia called Cherry Hill, which is in New Jersey, which is where I'm speaking from right now. One, is, as you said, is from Turkey, and one from Jordan. Mm-hmm. One of those lived in Philadelphia, another in the suburb of Philadelphia.
Go ahead.
We have a 27-page criminal complaint that details how federal officials used an informant since January of 2006 to track these men. A representative of a retail store reported that someone brought a video camera in to be converted to DVD, or the videotape to be converted to DVD, and that videotape showed 10 men, six of whom are the suspects, and they were yelling Allah Akbar, which means God is great, and shooting assault weapons at targets.
And they had this taken to be copied. Well, we understand that there were also secret recordings, as you said, some documents, there's some information. What else have you heard?
Well, the FBI, following that tip, detailed meetings in that criminal complaint. They recorded where they allegedly plotted to attack Fort Dix in Burlington County in New Jersey. And they also allegedly had looked at some other targets. There's conflicting information about exactly which ones those are, but one of them is rumored to be the U.S. Coast Guard facility on the Delaware River waterfront in Philadelphia.
Well, WNBC Radio in New York is saying the family of one man owns a pizzeria near Fort Dix, and we know a New Jersey congressman is saying he was told by federal prosecutors that one suspect delivered pizzas to the base. Did they have entree to the base?
I don't have that that information. I didn't hear that.
Well, and we also know, and perhaps you've heard this as well, on a secret recording, the government is saying, or at least one of the criminal complaints against one of the suspects alleges that one of the suspects said, "I can assure you, you can hit an American base very easily." What are people in the community saying? Have you had a chance to talk around the town?
I did. I just spoke with about a dozen people at a supermarket here in Cherry Hill. Most of them had not heard about this, had not heard that that these men had been arrested, that this took place at all. The ones who had heard had very sketchy information, and some of them said it made them very apprehensive to know that these men may have been living for years in this community, which is a middle-class community, pretty sleepy town, suburb of Philadelphia. And some actually said that they were reassured by it, that the federal government has stepped up efforts to track terrorists as soon as they know about them.
That's Shai Ben-Yaakov, a reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Again, federal prosecutors will be holding a press conference at 2:30 East Coast time today. And Shai, then at that time, I guess we'll learn much more. But thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the campus of Virginia Tech is getting ready for this weekend's commencement ceremony, less than a month after a student opened fire, killing 32 other students and professors before killing himself. Posthumous awards will be given to the students who died. Photos of the deceased will be flashed on a giant screen during the ceremonies, and families of the victims will receive school rings. There are no plans to mention the gunman, Sung Wee Cho. Cho, as you remember, was a senior at Virginia Tech. In 2005, a judge declared him an imminent threat to himself and others, and he had been ordered to receive treatment. According to the Washington Post, Cho did not get that care, and no one seems to have followed up on the judge's order. Well, Arthur Kaplan says he is furious about that hole in the safety net of health care. Not as much because of what happened at Virginia Tech, as Arthur says, very rarely does a mentally ill person turn violent. But he says it's because every day people fall through a hole in mental health care and are more likely to hurt themselves or cause society in other ways. Kaplan is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He joins us now. Arthur Kaplan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We've spoken here on this program about the porous safety net for people who are mentally ill. How do you feel the mental health system has failed?
Well, it depends on how many hours we have. It's failed in so many ways, but the major ways are it basically does not have enough people providing services. Benefits coverage is terrible. Many health plans don't even offer any mental health coverage. We don't have coordination between the police and mental health authorities. We have information about people at risk or people causing problems that just gets lost in the system. And we're not even taking advantage of some of the latest and more interesting therapeutic ideas in terms of therapy, both pharmacological and talk therapy, because there's no financial incentive to sort of move those things along. So it's failed on many, many, many fronts.
Well, let's take one at a time. You talked about insurance plans and whether or not they offer mental health. Some critics say when they do, it's not on parity with other medical coverage. Tell us about that.
Well, we almost had a perfect storm in the mid-'80s in the United States. We had a president, Ronald Reagan, who was looking to cut the federal budget and state budgets. And when he was governor of California, he'd done the same thing. And a huge cost area, obviously, was health care, and they were trying to get a handle on that. And basically, they deinstitutionalized everyone from state facilities, thereby creating the current health care system for the mentally ill, which is the street, and to a slightly lesser extent, prisons.
And part of that perfect storm at that time was a movement, a very sincere movement, to bring the mentally ill more rights, to get them out of warehousing.
Right. Well, the movement was this: stop ignoring them, stop isolating them, stop warehousing them, and I should add, don't stop drugging them, and integrate more people with mental illness into the community. And I think it was a good faith effort. We got the deinstitutionalization part down. We did not integrate anybody into the community. There are a few halfway houses. To some extent, people with mental retardation were absorbed into the community, but the mentally ill were left out on the street or wound up in the prisons or wound up committing different types of antisocial behavior and driving families up the wall who tried to cope with them.
Another aspect at the same time was advances in drugs, advances in medication. These were seen as miracles at first, but how did they then, in your mind, become a part of the problem?
Well, there were advances, and we finally came up with some medicines that calmed people down and could tranquilize people without making them completely dopey, and those medicines were breakthroughs. But what we did was we just substituted pills for people in healthcare. Conversation ended. Drugs began. The cheapest way to deal with someone with mental illness was quite simply to give them a pill, and that's what we did. So we didn't get at the root cause of problems. We didn't address family issues. We didn't address anything about the origins of mental health issues. We didn't teach anybody any coping skills. We just gave out pills.
Well, but as we were saying, there have been attempts to bring parity in mental health coverage because one of your criticisms, as I read, is that if there is coverage, for instance, there's a limit on the number of visits. What are some of the ways that people have tried to change that?
Well, both in the U.S. Senate and in different state legislatures, people have tried to say, if you have health care coverage, then it ought to have the same level, if you will, of financial money put into it. Economics shouldn't discriminate between physical health and mental health. But still, in state after state, plan after plan, you see things like 30 days available for overnight mental health coverage. Now, anybody who can cure somebody of major mental illness by a 30-night stay in a hospital, I'd like to meet.
What would you suggest? What do you think has to happen?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that need to be done. First, I think we need to redress an ethics problem, which is bowing too much in the direction of the rights of people who are mentally ill. What? It's obviously wrong to warehouse them, but saying that you can't hold somebody for a week or 2 weeks to evaluate them if they don't consent to that is craziness.
This is a tricky area, as you well know. As we were saying, there was a huge movement for more rights for the mentally ill. Some feel the pendulum has swung too far in the other way. Give us some examples of how that works.
If you have an anorexic daughter and she's been dying because she won't eat, and you take her down to a mental health facility, they're going to say, are you suicidal today? Do you want to kill yourself? She'll say no. And they'll ask, are you a threat to anyone else? And she'll say no. And they'll say, we can't keep her. She doesn't want to be here. And there are instances after instances of people who are having violent outbreaks, can't get out of bed, are burning down the house that they live in, and on it goes. And we can't hold them. Even for evaluation purposes, the stigma against mental illness and the desire to give rights to people to control their medical care when their very competency is self-evidently not present, when they weigh 70 pounds and have to be carried through the door of the institution and are still saying no, I think that's just going too far in the direction of some kind of, it's rotting with your rights on, as I sometimes say.
Well, it reminds me of author Pete Early, who's written the book Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, you know of this, who writes how his son was clearly in trouble, and yet the police told him, unless the father said that his son had threatened to kill him, there was nothing they could do. So this father is faced with this quandary of now having a more serious charge against his son in order to get his son the help that he needed.
Sometimes the only way to get that care is to give your son or spouse or loved one a police record. So, again, this is way, way over too far on the spectrum of individual rights. No one's going to lose their civil liberties in 2 weeks. No one's going to lose their civil liberties by being forced into an evaluation for more than 72 hours, which is the longest most people can be held in most parts of the country. We've got to start to treat mental illness seriously and say, you know, it's great to have consent, but, you know, we don't want to be out there harming people or not letting them get better because we can't even evaluate them. I'm not talking about treatment. I'm just talking about evaluation.
Well, let's talk about treatment. Can a mentally ill person who's been diagnosed, let's say even a court-ordered diagnosis, can they refuse care? Can they decide to, for instance, just take their medications and not take the talk therapy or group counseling prescribed with it?
There are plenty of people who have serious depression, who are manic, who have all kinds of mental illnesses, who are directing their own care. Now, it's the only part of healthcare that I know of. It certainly doesn't happen in surgery. It certainly doesn't happen in internal medicine, where the patient sort of says, yeah, I'll do this and I won't do that, and I don't think this is appropriate. You can be in the hospital and say, well, I'll take these pills, but I won't take those pills, even though you've been deemed mentally ill.
That's University of Pennsylvania bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. When we return, then, how to balance, you know, the hard-fought-for civil rights of the mentally ill with the need to ensure their safety and, on rare occasion, the safety of others. And while we have him, we want to ask him about another story in the news, the move to hold and isolate repeat sex offenders after their prison time is up. 19 states have now instituted some form of commitment. That's coming up next. And later, how they're doing in Kansas with the relief work after the tornado when much of their equipment that's needed is in Iraq. That's later. Back after a quick break, here and now. And now back with bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, who says one problem with mental health care is that there's no provision for patients who choose not to be treated. Arthur Kaplan, you know rights advocates are wary of this conversation. How do you balance hard-fought-for civil rights of the mentally ill, who rarely present a problem, with your concerns?
Well, I'm going to say something that won't be popular, perhaps, but I think the hard-fought-for civil rights issues are not giving people autonomy and liberty. They're leaving them mentally ill and impaired. If it was the case that we could say, by giving you these rights, we enhance your autonomy, we enhance your self-determination, I don't see it. What I see is people who are still unable to function, can't work, can't be at home, can't get along with loved ones, lose their marriages, drive their families away, and Is that a matter of self-determination? I mean, these rights, if you will, are instrumental. They're supposed to allow you to do more. They're not there intrinsically as valuable. They're supposed to facilitate your liberty and your ability to be the kind of person you want to be.
I know we're going to hear from people who say, I have the right to lose my family. I have the right to be antisocial. But, of course, there's the rare occasion, and it's very rare, we want to say that, when one of these, one of these cases becomes, you know, a national headline. And again, it's very rare.
Well, the mentally ill are not especially dangerous or risky to others, but there are some subpopulations, people who have violent outbursts, real anger management problem issues, weapons, and that kind of anger doesn't mix. And I think we've seen the profiles from Columbine all the way up to Virginia Tech. So there, you may want to say if anybody's got a restraining order on them, if they've been in situations where their boss or others worry about their stalking behavior or violent behavior, that's what I'm talking about when I say maybe a week or a two-week evaluation and then some sort of forced counseling if you have the restraining order as part of that. Integrating police activity with mental health makes sense.
Well, Arthur Kaplan, everything you've said entails more people. And as you said at the outset, there's not the financial interest. The insurance companies don't have an interest in paying for therapy when there's drugs that they feel can cover these illnesses. Who pays for this?
Well, I think we all should pay for it. And I think enough families in America are touched by mental illness that they need to rally and begin to bring political pressure. Both mental health benefits must be covered, and that they must have parity with the kind of amounts of money available to treat physical illness. You know, most policies will pay up to $1 million for a cancer patient, saying that you're going to cap off what you pay for mental health at 30 days, which basically would cost about $10,000. Why? I do think it's going to cost us a bit more, but given the amount of money we spend on the police side, the jail side, the homeless side, I can't imagine that there's not going to be at least a break even here.
But you also write there has to be another element here, which is reducing the stigma and calling it an illness.
It absolutely is a part of it. We look out there and we see people who have cancer of the stomach, who have emphysema from smoking, who have alcohol-related problems in their liver. We don't run around saying we're not going to transplant people who've caused damage to their liver by binge drinking and so on. We don't mix blame with physical disease because we tend to think of it as a price we pay for certain activities and certain lifestyles and so forth. Mental health, I can't tell you the number of people who would say, well, that's just a weakness of will. You can see it in books like The Secret, which are around these days, which are basically saying, you know, get your head straight, and that's how you're going to both live well and make things happen. But obviously, we know enough about mental illness to know that that is nonsense. You're not going to will your way to mental health.
Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Art, with an accent on the ethics portion of that, I just want to ask you one last question before we let you go. We recently have the news of Washington State being the first state in the country to make a decision to take its imprisoned sexual predators, people who have raped repeatedly, for instance, and after their prison sentences are up, they are moving them to a former mental health institution on an island off the coast of the state. You, I'm sure, know that Andrew Vosh spoke of this 20 years ago. He said that sexual predators, sexual offenders could not be rehabilitated and that we needed to house them separately from the general population. That caused a huge outcry at the time.
I think the data shows that there is a lot of repeat offenders. I think we're not very good at curing, treating, trying to modify that behavior. It doesn't mean we couldn't get better if we would start to spend some money on mental health research, if we would start to make mental health not a ghetto within medicine, we probably could make some advances on this front. We may need a war on sexual predatory behavior. In the meantime, I think isolation and probation and monitoring and the old anklet bracelet probably are going to be the best we have. But that can't be the end of it. That can't be the end of it. I mean, isolation, sure, but let's not say that the solution to sexual crimes in America is to find a new Australia. And that's what Washington State is doing. It's what they did in the 19th century, send the convicts and the crazies far, far away. I'm not saying I wouldn't even advocate some of that to protect the public health, but it has to be conditional on serious efforts to try and come up with better answers, pharmacological, surgical, talk therapy, whatever it's going to take. But the amount of money we've spent to solve that problem is nothing. So probably the best we can do is prison, jail, Megan's Law, don't live near me, live under the underpass with your fellow offenders, or go out to an island.
But am I hearing you? What am I hearing you say? Because you're saying, it seems to me, that we need to spend more money on the issue of sexual predators and repeat sexual offenders. There are others who are saying no amount of money can fix that problem, that this is something that is just not rehabilitatable.
Yeah, that I don't believe. I think that given the current state of the art, we don't quite know what to do. And monitoring and isolation and jail tend to be the answers we've got. But I think if you looked at the revolution that's going on in the brain sciences, if you looked at how we're understanding how the brain works, we have some hope for the future of being able to pinpoint, isolate people who are at risk, really decide who's been treated and can be released safely in terms of taking scans of their brains or understanding their chemistry. I think things can be done, and that's part of the reason I'm so angry. It's not that I think we have options now for cure or remediation of sexual predators. I don't. We could move into the 21st century here. We have the cognitive and brain science revolution going on all around us. Let's put some money in there and start to use it to take us into a better stance toward all sorts of mental health problems. You can see the science ready to move, but there's no budget.
Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we'll do more on this issue. Can't do enough. Back after the news, here and now.
Support for Here and Now.
The Missouri River and other waterways in the Midwest are spilling over their banks, forcing thousands of people to evacuate and bringing warning that the region could see flooding as devastating as the floods of 1993. Missouri's governor has declared a state of emergency and mobilized the National Guard to help. Meanwhile, in Greensburg, Kansas, rescue workers are continuing to look for survivors in debris piles as high as 30 feet deep. The last rescue was Saturday morning when two elderly women were pulled from the wreckage of a Mennonite church. President Bush is expected to tour the tornado damage there tomorrow, and he'll probably hear the concerns of Governor Kathleen Sebelius. For more on the recovery, we're joined by Major General Todd Bunting, who heads the Kansas National Guard as the Adjutant General. And first of all, how are things going in Kansas today?
Well, we're doing all right. We've got a clear day here so far in Kansas, so of all the things that we need, that's the number one thing, is for the rain and the storms to stop. So far, so good.
Well, because we know that yesterday the real concern was of flooding. There is flooding in the region, but flooding in the area where the tornado hit hardest.
Right. Flying over it yesterday afternoon, there are certainly all of the creeks and things are out of their banks. But yesterday's weather was dry in Greensburg, so a lot of that will quickly make its way towards the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. Well, we'll bring us up to date, Major General. First of all, are people still reported missing?
We have not had, at this point in time, any phone calls from anyone reporting someone missing. We've been over every part of the town with the teams at least twice, and we're going over again today. But you have to see the level of devastation in some of this rubble 20, 30 feet deep to know that there is that. We have to be very honest with you. There is that possibility, but we have absolutely no cases where someone has said, I'm concerned about someone at this address, because as soon as we would have ever gotten that, we would have focused our entire energy in that area.
Well, you talk about the piles of rubble. Let's talk about the resource questions, because as you well know, your governor has been saying that she's concerned that there's not enough National Guard equipment, that it's been deployed to Iraq. In fact, the Wichita Eagle is reporting that she both wrote a letter to then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld asking for a replacement of equipment in 2005, spoke to President Bush in 2006 when he came to visit Kansas and posed the same concern. And now we have Colonel Eric Peck of the Kansas Guard telling the Eagle that the Guard is lacking large transport trucks to clear debris. Normally, you'd have 30, now 15 large trucks. Normally, 600 Humvees, now 400. And those tactical vehicles that are used to transport people and equipment, they have that civilian cab over a truck, normally 170, now less than 30 on hand. So what are your concerns?
Well, we appreciate our governor's support. She has mentioned that in two respects. We have what we need in Greensburg, Some of those trucks, though, are very much in short supply. And with the flooding, some of those high-profile vehicles would be essential if the flooding had gotten any worse. So what we have, though, is with our correct amount of equipment, we could handle two or three major storms in the state and be on the scene in a matter of hours. We understand the Emergency Management Assistance Program, and we could go to our neighboring states. But, for example, with the flooding in Missouri, they would probably not be available right now. So what she's mentioning is that the very best way to have a safe and quick response is to have the equipment that you, at least all the equipment you should have here. Some of it we have an adequate supply. Overall, though, we're short. We're at 60%. We're fine in Greensburg, but with that series of storms for 3 days, if we'd had another major storm, we would have been in stretched thin.
Well, you might still.
Absolutely. But the other aspect that we really want to get in front of people is she's also talking about the training aspect. And that with only 60% of the equipment, we're hard-pressed to keep all of our soldiers trained to the level that we would want them to because of the deployed equipment or the equipment that's brought back that's now being returned to serviceable condition. So she's also saying, hey, long-term, if you don't give my people the equipment, they can't respond and save lives and put the public back in order. But they also have a real hard time getting trained because they don't have the tools available to stay current and trained on. So it's actually a two-pronged aspect. And well, what we're going to focus on in the weeks ahead is Greensburg, and we'll leave the long-term discussions about equipment to the policymakers. But we appreciate the fact that our governor knows our issues, and she knows that there's a near-term issue of response and a long-term issue of just having enough equipment to stay trained on, so that if we need to do something in Kansas, we can, or if we need to continue to go anywhere in the world and fight the nation's wars, we can do that too. And you have to have enough equipment to be trained on,
right,
so that when you go to those places, you're safe and highly skilled, and you can do your job well.
Well, let's ask you just one question about the long term, because the governor also said that the Pentagon told her that Kansas could expect, and this is again reported in the Wichita Eagle, that Kansas could expect to regain 2/3 of the vehicles and equipment that are now deployed elsewhere in about 6 years.
There you go.
Does that worry you? Six years to wait for to get the 2/3 back?
Absolutely. I would ask people to consider what it would be like to go up to somebody who is a specialist on a piece of equipment and say, we're going to get you a darn fine piece of equipment in 6 years. So 6 years from now, you're going to be a highly trained person with some great stuff. Don't know exactly what we're going to do between now and then, and that's an extreme case. But the reality is we don't have enough equipment day to day. But we understand that, too, and that there's a war going on, and we're fighting that war. And what we have is a governor who's standing up for us and saying, hey, the nation's at war, but we still have a homeland to defend, and so we need adequate resources, mm-hmm. and that's what we want our elected leaders to do for us. We don't pick the fights. We don't pick where we go. We just ask for people to give us the tools we need to do that job, mm-hmm. and if you do that, we will. But I also want to stress, we've been contacted by our neighbor states. I've talked to the people in the National Guard Bureau and other folks. We know who we can call and get them here quickly. But the real issue with equipment is with a series of storms in a region, it might be that the response equipment has to come from a great distance away. And in many cases, that's where the challenge is. We know we can get all the resources of the federal government here in a couple of days, but sometimes you need equipment there in a matter of minutes or hours. We really only focus on what we're doing here to do as best we can. But I'll also say that, you know, we would gladly go to other states. That's what we do as guardsmen and as a state. And what's going on in Greensburg is the best of Kansas and FEMA right now.
Well, I would second that. But then I'd also voice, well, you stand at the ready to go to other states, but you're depleted as well. Can you give us more of a sense of what's going on there? We've been seeing these unbelievable pictures from Greensburg. Where are people living? What are they saying to you when you do get to talk to neighbors and friends? I mean, what's the mood like there?
Absolutely inspiring. The people have taken a hard 1-2 punch of it, the most devastating storm as possible. It got the entire town, and it literally destroyed everything. It's not partially damaged. It's totally destroyed. But they're resilient, and they're ready to bounce back. Coming and going today, the challenge is the fine balance between letting people have access to get their precious items and their critical items out of their homes, but also needing to clear away debris so that the public structure can come back.
Well, I want to ask, too, I mean, is there, yesterday there was an evacuation, a partial evacuation after an ammonia leak. Is there concern about people coming back to get their precious things? I mean, are the structures safe?
Well, and that's part of the reason we brought in extra teams. Yes, there are still some structures there that, you know, with some roofs partially hanging on or whatever, that the last thing we'd want is any more injuries or worse from this storm. As tough as it is, it's inspiring to be around them because they're going to come back stronger than ever.
That's Major General Todd Bunting. He's the Kansas Adjutant General, talking about the recovery efforts in Greensburg, Kansas. Major General, thanks very much and best to you.
Absolutely. Please keep your thoughts and prayers for folks in Greensburg and throughout the state with in Bennington with these serious storms. We could use a little sunshine and a break from Mother Nature for a while in your thoughts and prayers.
Okay, duly noted. Well, still to come today, from Fu Manchu to Bruce Lee, Asian actors try to overcome a Hollywood stereotype. You're listening to Here and Now. The chance that an Iraqi child will live beyond age 5 has plummeted faster than anywhere else in the world since 1990. That from a report issued today by Save the Children, which placed Iraq last in child survival rankings. Now, you might say that's not surprising. Iraq had 15 years of sanctions followed by an ongoing war. But still, the mortality rate for kids is 150% higher than it was 15 years ago. Today, 1 in 8 Iraqi children died of disease or violence before reaching their 5th birthday. Mary Beth Powers is senior health expert for Save the Children. She's here with more. And Mary Beth, how are they dying? What kinds of diseases?
Kids in Iraq die just like kids in a lot of other developing countries die, from diseases like pneumonia or diarrhea, which are major killers of children. The thing is, they're both simple to treat, but if kids can't get to health care or parents can't get the medicines they need for their children, then children won't survive.
What's disturbing is that your report says that before the war, Iraq was plagued by electricity shortages, a lack of clean water, too few hospitals. One would think that after a liberation, there might be better services, but as we well know, there aren't.
Right. Improving services in any setting where there's a conflict, whether it's Iraq or Sierra Leone, has always proved quite difficult. It certainly complicates both their access to education, health care, as well as it's just dangerous.
Now, there's other bad news. For instance, that survival rates that had been gaining in some countries, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, are now declining. Why is that?
Yeah, child mortality rates in Africa that we're showing signs of improvement are declining because of AIDS. So while AIDS isn't a major killer globally of children, in a number of sub-Saharan African countries, it's an increasing cause of death for children.
Well, we should point out the biggest improvements in survival rates for kids under 5, because they took place in Egypt, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Nepal, which also has conflict. And as you write, very simple interventions can go a long way in saving kids. What are they?
Well, one thing that Nepal did right was really engage community health workers, women inside communities, at promoting breastfeeding, at giving vitamin A, which is very protective against a number of diseases. It helps kids survive measles or survive respiratory infections. And in Nepal, a huge coverage campaign, twice a year doses of vitamin A, which costs only 2 cents a dose, were given to children. And that's really helped protect Nepali children despite the internal conflict in Nepal over the last few years.
We understand that family planning has played a big role in good health, especially in Egypt. Egypt, as you report, lowered its child mortality rate by 68% by, they say, improving care for pregnant women and providing better family planning. But many of the countries cited in the report receive financial aid from the U.S. government, and the Bush administration has made an abstinence policy a part of its plank for aid. How has that, if it has, affected any mortality rates?
Actually, the good news is that the policy of the U.S. government in favor of family planning, voluntary contraceptive programs throughout the developing world, it has been continued through the Bush administration. So, in fact, a lot of the countries that made the biggest reductions, those are all major recipients of U.S. government assistance for maternal child health, including family planning programs, which the U.S. government sponsored.
Quick question, though, about funding. We understand funding for child survival programs has leveled off. There are private concerns. Bill and Melinda Gates, for instance, given millions. Where's the money not coming from?
For the last 12 years, we've basically seen no increases in U.S. government assistance for maternal child survival globally. And that's disturbing because, frankly, we were a global leader on this issue for many, many years, and we should continue that leadership role to encourage countries like Egypt to spend more of their own resources on maternal child health programs. And that has been shown to be effective.
We see that the U.S. is only 26, tied with Croatia, Estonia, and Poland in child mortality rates. What are children in the U.S. dying from?
first of all, there's a lot of death in the United States due to prematurity. So women not getting enough care during pregnancy, which leads to premature birth, and that's a high-risk condition for any newborn. But secondly, accidents, whether they're drowning or car accidents or children not in a safety seat, et cetera, is a major cause of death in the United States.
Mary Beth Power, senior health expert for Save the Children. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Well, next, he plays the bad guy in the hit show 24. Of course he does. He's Asian. There are few roles out there. That's ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Let's talk about Asian men in film. In the 30s and 40s, they were often portrayed, often by white actors in makeup, as evil, mind-controlling geniuses.
You have no will, no mind of your own. You will do only what I command you to do.
Later, they were martial artists. Bruce Lee first came to prominence as the Green Hornet sidekick Kato. Or they were nerds. Remember Long Duck Dong, the Chinese exchange student in the 1984 film 16 Candles? He can't speak English, but he can do chores.
Pushing lawn mowing machine so Grandpa's hyena don't get disturbed.
Hernia!
Well, as a new documentary points out, Asian actors have struggled over the past century or so to get beyond stereotypes with varying degrees of success. The Slanted Screen is being shown this week on public television stations, and for more, we're joined from KQED in San Francisco by filmmaker Jeff Adachi. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
We're also joined by actor Tai Ma. He's profiled in the documentary, and many of you are saying, hey, he's also that guy that was just on the Fox show 24. Tai, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Jeff, you call your documentary The Slanted Screen. Some might say that's a pejorative word. You know, what do you mean by that?
Well, we came up with the title as a way to sort of play on that, because we used to hear the little rhymes about slanted eyes. And when I grew up in the 60s, the images that I saw on television about Asian men were always negative. It was the nerd, the villain, the gangster, or someone who couldn't fit in. And the actors who had to play these roles were in a catch-22, because when they played these roles, they were criticized by their own communities for demeaning Asian people. And on the other hand, they had to feed their families.
And, you know, we don't make assumptions here, but you are of Asian descent.
That's right.
So this is personally important to you.
Right. It was such a disconnect between how I knew Asians were and the way in which we were portrayed on television. And you just didn't see any superheroes that were Asian. I mean, you grew up playing, you know, Batman and Robin, and all the superheroes are Caucasian, sometimes black, but never Asian. Yeah. And so we also talk about the fact that there are a few exceptions. Bruce Lee, for example, came along, and he sort of became this real-life superhero to a lot of kids, and eventually became an icon because of his martial arts skills.
You mentioned Bruce Lee and his impact on, you know, sort of changing some of these images. But on the other hand, he might set up a whole new stereotype.
Right. When Bruce Lee's films came out, it was like that song, Kung Fu Fighting. Everybody was out there doing kung fu. And I hear Tai laughing, and I'm sure it was like that for him, too. But the thing of it is that in a way it became a stereotype in and of itself, where the only time you saw an Asian guy is when he's doing kung fu. One of the things we talk about in the film is that there was a study done, a national study, where they polled children of all nationalities to see what their impressions were. A lot of kids said, anytime you see an Asian on TV, they're always doing kung fu. That's what they do.
Well, but then there's the other stereotype. Asian young men in particular as nerds. John Hughes' 16 Candles, the Coen brothers' Fargo. Is that the latest stereotype?
Well, you know, I do think that portrayals of Asian males are inaccurate, and it's because the roles are often written by people who see Asian males, you know, stereotypic type characters. And so a writer might think, okay, let's spice up the script. Let's put in an Asian nerd or an Asian gang. But, you know, on the other extreme, the writer or the studio doesn't think, let's make the hero Asian. One of the people we interviewed, producer Terrence Chang, talks about his experiences making a film with Chow Yun-fat in Hollywood. It's called The Replacement Killers, and he was told that the bad guys in the film had to be Asian, and that was one of the stipulations that the studio gave him. They just didn't want an Asian hero pitted against Caucasian bad guys.
That reminds me, Tai, I want to ask you, in the documentary, actor Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa talks about playing an evil character in the film Mortal Kombat, and he speaks about why he plays evil Asian roles even though he's been criticized. Let's listen to that.
If I'm going to choose between a wimpy businessman and playing a bad guy, I'm going to play a bad guy because I got balls. I got balls. And I want kids to grow up to know the Asian man got balls.
You know, Ty, your thoughts about that choice?
Say that again.
Your thoughts about that choice. I mean, he feels it's between one and the other.
I think, you know, Carrie has a point, you know, in the sense that he would choose, quote-unquote, strength over weakness. My choice would be variety over everything else, that I need roles, and I try to really implement in my choices that I create, because ultimately, it's not just the writing. It's not just, you know, what kind of film or projects you do. You have to be able to go in there and say, okay, I am a contributor, artistic contributor to this particular project. Mm. I'm not a puppet to this particular project.
When you audition for a role, how does it work? Are you called in just for roles where they want an Asian man, or do you go wider than that?
Well, by and large, I mean, you do get called in for your quote-unquote ethno-specific roles.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, we get crossed over, not too often. So I think the lesson here is that regardless of what role we fill, the way we look is going to change what we do. Very seldom are we portrayed in more of a normal Americana setting, which neighbors, your mechanic, your insurance agent, your doctor, you know. So those are the things that I try to strive for, is some kind of normalcy.
Right now, most listeners know you from the character you play on the hit series, mm-hmm, 24, Cheng Zi, if I said that.
Chengzhi.
Well, this is the government official who tortured and interrogated Jack Bauer for 2 years in between seasons 5 and 6, kidnaps Audrey, Jack Bauer's longtime love, forces Jack to steal a Russian nuclear component in season 6.
I've interfaced the component.
You should have the schematics.
Yes, they've downloaded. I'm running a diagnostic on the component now.
Good. We'll be there in less than an hour.
Is this a throwback to the evil Asian?
Okay, well, I think if everybody followed, the people who followed 24, the character began his journey as the head of security for the Chinese consulate. And what happened was Jack violated the sovereign rights of China by invading the consulate, and the Chinese consul was killed. That's why my character was brought in. His responsibility was to take him into custody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of what Jack does.
Ah. Yeah, well,
you know, and the method in which Jack employs is fairly the same method as he employs.
Right, and nobody says, is this a throwback to the evil white man? To
that's
him.
Right. So, right. In some ways, you know, there are a lot of double standards, really.
Hmm.
I really were very intrigued by this particular character in 24 when we first started, because here is basically a mirror image of Jack Bauer.
Hmm. Thinking of Jeff's film, which you are in, there's a scene in it from the movie Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, and in it, actor Jason Scott Lee, playing Bruce Lee, he and his white girlfriend go to see Breakfast at Tiffany's, and he sits in the audience and watches Mickey Rooney playing the upstairs neighbor. This is a caricature of a Japanese man with buck teeth and glasses. He's sort of a funny character back then. And Jason...
Not really.
No,
some people,
right.
Maybe.
Do you have memories of seeing caricatures like that?
Oh, God, I mean, we're not even talking about images of being so far back. We're talking about now. Just most recently, Rosie O'Donnell in The View.
Well, tell us more about that. I missed that.
Danny DeVito was on the show the day before, and I think he was appeared drunk. There was some complaint, so a few days later, mm-hmm, Rosie defended him by saying, you know, even if this show was being talked about in China, she mimicked a particular talk show, some talk show, fictitious talk show in China, going, Ching Chong, Ching Chong, Ching Chong, Ching Chong. So, you know, we don't have to go that far. Mm-hmm. It hurts. I mean, this goes across America.
Tai Ma, an actor who appears in the documentary The Slanted Screen. By the way, for more information on The Slanted Screen, go to our website, here-now.org. Tai, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And we've also been speaking with Jeff Adachi, director-producer of the film. Jeff, thank you.
It's good talking to you, Robin, and take care, Tai.
Take care. Good talking to you, Jeff.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.